Several times in this passage that we have read, Peter mentions something about what his audience used to be. And his exhortations here, I think, reflect some of those things as he tells them basically three things. Number one is prepare. Prepare for action, he will tell them. Number two is act appropriately, or as the word he uses, conduct themselves appropriately. And finally, to know for sure that God has redeemed them. So prepare, act, and know. Those are the things that Peter wants them to think about as he goes into his exhortation for this particular group as he's writing to them. In verses 13 through 16, we see him talk about them, the need to be prepared for action. And that's an interesting way of saying it. Prepare for action. One of the things I've read over the years is how nations conduct their wars. And I have only a smidgen of knowledge of wartime strategies. But the fact is, in the West, we have studied this and come up with certain ways that we feel like is right to wage war. Okay? And I'm not trying to suggest that war is right. War is something that's a part of who we are. We're never going to get away from it in this life. I'm sorry to say that. We live in a world of conflict. But Plato understood one of the fundamental concepts of fighting a war. And he said, true courage is the ability of a soldier to fight and stay in rank even when he knows the odds are against him. He had to be mentally prepared to stay there and fight. And I'm not so sure that's all that much different than what Peter is saying. Stand and fight. Be prepared to stand and fight. I think this is why at Valley Forge, General Washington brought in a Prussian general from Europe to actually train his troops to fight properly and to stay in rank. Before most of the battles that they fought, as soon as the enemy came and as soon as they came marching in rank, staying together as a column, more often than not, the troops of the Americas would just break and run because they didn't know how to stand and fight against such a united front. Once they learned that, they could learn how to fight. They'd learn how to do it. But you see, it takes preparation and it takes training to do that. You have to learn how to fight. You have to be prepared. One of the fundamental aspects of Western military affairs, as one writer put it, is that war cannot be left in the hands of hotheads, even brave hotheads, because more often than not, they do something that's just impulsive rather than staying disciplined. You see, what ends up happening is war takes reflection and reason. We don't think about it that way. And we know once that a plan comes off paper and gets into the field, it's going to change. Because war is basically chaos, as the Roman god of war was called. Chaos. But the fact is, you have to know what you're going to do before you do it. Prepare for action. Fighting demands preparation. Fighting demands discipline. And if nothing else, we are in battles. We're in battles for our souls. And Peter's exhortation does sound very similar to that, does it not? He says, prepare your minds for action. Realize that you are in a battle. I would like to think it's probably nothing more than the battle of sportsmanship, you know, where as soon as the kickoff goes, there's a fight going on. There's a real battle for who's going to get the most yardage and the most points. But it's a little more serious than that for the Christian. Our souls are at stake. And so he tells them, be sober-minded. Be disciplined in your battle. Think about what you're doing. Keep your wits about you when things become chaotic. Don't run. As soon as the battle begins, don't just get scared and run. Stay disciplined. Prepare for what you've got to do. I think there's a little bit inherent in what we talked about this morning in discipleship. Count the cost of discipleship. Realize what's involved in following Christ. Realize what the issues are at stake in this battle. So Peter tells them, be sober-minded. Stop and think. Set your hope fully on the grace that is available to you. The battle ultimately belongs to God. You have the strength because you have been given extra strength and divine help from God Himself. That's what grace is. It's essentially divine help. It's not only guidance, but it's help in the midst of chaos, help in the midst of a battle. And here he says, do not be conformed to the passions of your former ignorance. And remember I said at the beginning, Peter mentioned something about what they used to be. And here's one of them. Formerly, you really didn't know how to fight. Maybe you didn't know you had to fight. Maybe you didn't know what the terms and the issues in the battle were. So in your former ignorance, don't follow those things anymore. You've learned now about what the fight is all about, and so reject those sinful patterns. They're going to keep getting you into trouble. It's kind of like what happens maybe with your computer sometimes when it hangs up. I don't know that I know exactly what's going on when it does that, but it seems like it's in this sort of loop that it just can't get out of. Somebody's got to come in and break it. You have to just maybe reboot the computer, but it can't seem to get out of it by itself. And that's kind of what happens in our thought patterns. We get into these circular reasonings and we stay in trouble because we don't break the pattern. Whatever, there's any number of different patterns that those can be, but the fact is something has to interject itself into that situation so the pattern is broken. And Peter is saying here, don't go based on what your former passions were, because those loops, those things got you in trouble. The former things were values from your past, and those things have to be overturned and broken. And it's at this standpoint, Peter says something that we know is a very important part of our sanctification, and that is simply, be holy. He throws in this religious idea, which is really what we're all about, but Peter's exhortation boils down to this, be different, be like God. That's really what he's saying, I think, when he says, be holy, be like God. And that is different from our former way of thinking, isn't it? So the first thing he tells them is prepare. Prepare for action. Be ready. The second exhortation that I think he has here is that he says simply, act. Now he says it this way. Conduct yourselves, he says, conduct yourselves with fear throughout the time of your exile. That's in verse 17. Basically, act appropriately. Behave the right way. And he makes the foundation of his argument something that we assume to be true about the nature of God. He says, if you call on an impartial God. Now think about that impartiality for just a moment. Peter argues from this common assumption that God doesn't take bribes. God doesn't judge things based on, well, I like this person, so I'll judge fairly for him. Or this person's given me money. Or I can get something out of this person, so I'll judge fairly. But this person, they're meaningless to me. You know, that's what unjust people do. They judge based on whether they can get something out of it. And it's very interesting, is it not, how Peter kind of learned this? I get the feeling, before we get to Acts chapter 10, verse 34 was the passage that John read just a little while ago. I suspect that before Peter got to Cornelius' house in Acts chapter 10, and that's the context, it's the first Gentile convert, Peter kind of knew this, that God is the God of impartiality. But then when he had to stand before a Gentile audience, he went, huh, now I really get that. Now I really understand what God's talking about when it says he judges impartially. It doesn't matter whether he's Jewish. It doesn't matter whether he's Gentile. It doesn't matter what nationality or race he comes from. God judges impartially. Peter makes his foundation on that very idea. And sometimes people try to defend essentially the indefensible. It's because they're a part of who they are. I've read a number of years ago that FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, our president during World War II, found out that there was some politician in Illinois who had been caught stealing. And FDR's response was, well, he may be a thief, but he's our thief. It's like, it didn't matter whether he broke the law, he's our guy. Okay? And, you know, you see this all the time, don't you? You know, movies and TV like to talk about the big blue wall of silence in the police department. Well, guess what? Everybody does this kind of thing. If somebody in your family did something illegal, you would kind of go, "Oh, I don't know if they really did that." Oh, you might say, "No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't take their side." But yeah, you'd at least be tempted. You know, I don't know them to be that way. Isn't it surprising that they did that? Maybe I want to defend them. And there's not necessarily something wrong with that. But you have to think about, well, what did they really do? I've heard over the years the story about this film producer, Roman Polanski. He was accused of, shall we say, putting this delicately, I guess, doing things to people who were not of the age of consent. And he ended up fleeing to Europe. And I still hear Hollywood types defending him. "Well, he's suffered enough. Maybe he should be able to come back, blah, blah, blah." Well, he's hardly suffered. You know, he's been living in Europe, out of the reach of our laws for all these years, but he still did that. So Hollywood, who likes to blame everybody else and say you've got this big blue wall of silence and all these other things, they're doing the same thing. I'm afraid, folks, we all do it. You know, everyone defends their own. God doesn't. God is impartial. He looks at what we do. And that's what Peter, I think, is trying to say when he says, conduct yourselves appropriately, conduct yourselves with fear throughout the time of your exile. That's because he knows, you know what? God's going to judge you totally impartially, totally based on what you do. He takes no bribes, and he caters his justice to no particular group. God's justice is above all that. His righteous nature itself determines his judgments. What God knows to be true determines his judgments. That's why Peter can say that God judges us according to our deeds. And if you call on him as Father who judges impartially according to each one's deeds, God doesn't look at what you have to offer him. God looks at what you do and says, okay, he did right, fine. He didn't do right, that's not so fine. But it's based on what you do above everything else. In Matthew chapter 7:21, Jesus told us something about that himself. Listen to his words here. "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven." See, even expressions of devotion are no substitute for doing the will of God. Only in this way will one enter the kingdom of heaven. It's not how many, and this is, I hope this doesn't sound wrong, it's not how many songs you sing. It's not how often you offer your devotion to God. I'd like to think those things move us in the direction of obedience, but if they don't, there's something wrong. Because it's by our deeds that God is going to judge us. And so that's why Peter can say we conduct ourselves with fear during this time of exile. It is by our deeds that God will judge us. And he's fair. Make no mistake about it. God is going to be fair. I certainly hope, in my case, he's going to judge me with mercy based on my deeds. But that's very much implied, I think, in what Peter is saying. Because now he says in verse 18, "Know that you have been ransomed from those futile ways that have been handed down from your forefathers." And again, think about the time frame here. Think about the past. I think Peter is probably talking about, well, let's talk about the idea of ransom first. In Mark chapter 10 and verse 45, Jesus makes a very, very profound statement. I don't even think the disciples fully grasp it yet at this point in the narrative. In Mark 10 and verse 45, the disciples have been having an argument about who's the greatest. And of course, we know the story. Jesus says, look, nobody's, you know, should be trying to elevate themselves above anybody else, for the greatest among you should be the servant among you. Not the one who's the top man, it's the man who's the bottom. who's the greatest, which sounds very odd to us, but true nonetheless. But what he says here in verse 45 is, even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve. And Jesus has a very specific way he's going to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. My suspicion is, by the time Peter writes this letter, he's gotten that idea. He really understands it. You have been ransomed. You have been bought back. In 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 19 through 20, Paul tells the Corinthians, says, guys, you're not your own anymore. You don't just belong to yourselves. You were bought with a price. Somebody else owns us. Now, I think in that passage, there are two things that motivate the Christian from understanding that very idea. First of all, we have a great deal of gratitude for the freedom that we have. You'll forgive me if you don't mind if I keep using illustrations from some of the readings I've been doing in the last couple of weeks. One of them I've mentioned before is by a guy named Captain Riley. In 1815, he was captured by the Barbary pirates in North Africa after his shipwreck on the shores of North Africa. And he was a slave for several months and treated horribly. But it's interesting, he goes to talk about this one particular Arab who was at least reasonably caring about him, even if he still considered him a slave, still got money for him when he was finally able to redeem himself. But he was at least somewhat compassionate toward him. And the reason this particular Arab was compassionate toward him, he told him later, he says, you know, something similar happened to me. I had been in a very bad situation. I thought I would never see my family again. So when I came across you, I at least understood what you were going through. And that's kind of interesting, isn't it? Once we sense some gratitude about what either life has done for us, in this case, what God has done for us, doesn't that make us behave differently? Or shouldn't it make us behave a little differently? And so it's out of gratitude for what God has done that we can do the same thing for others. We know we've been ransomed. That's why we serve God, because of our gratitude, our thankfulness. It's one of the things that moves us. Second, and the thing that Paul says, is, you know, we really don't own ourselves anymore. We are fortunate to serve a master who's treated us with the utmost love and concern, as well as given us our freedom back. But we still don't own ourselves. There's still a higher authority that we have to answer to, and that's God. And, of course, Jesus Christ, because it is Jesus Christ who has ransomed us. Now, what Peter says here harkens back to the past again. You have been ransomed from the futile ways inherited from our forefathers. We think that Peter is talking about his Jewish forefathers, the law of Moses, all the things that they thought they were going to get from Israel, and as a result of the covenant of Moses. And it was a good covenant. It was appropriate. It led them to understand what Jesus was doing for them. But there was a certain amount of futility in it. The futility, in part, was, you know what? It can't really fully forgive us of our sins. And just adhering to all the dietary laws was kind of futile at some point. It really didn't mean anything. It didn't get us into a good relationship with God. And so Peter can look at those things and he says there's a certain amount of futility involved in that. Now, think about your own life. Think about the things, and this isn't necessarily meant to cast aspersion on your families, but everybody has some former things in their way of life that maybe they can say, you know what, I kind of shouldn't have done it that way. Or maybe I was taught wrong. Maybe I was taught wrong in class. Maybe I was taught wrong by my family. Maybe I had some models in my life that weren't so great, and I followed them. There's a certain amount of futility in that because it's gotten me into those cycles of doing things that I can't seem to break out of. And I think that's what Peter may, by implication, be also talking about here. Not just the ways of the old law of Moses, but, you know, we've all got those futile ways of thinking that that have caused us problems. And again, forgive me if I use a Ayaan Hirsi Ali again. because I think she was a fascinating and still is a really, really fascinating individual. She grew up a Muslim. She has rejected it. She wrote an autobiography called Infidel, in which she describes why she did what she did. But she mentions a lot about values in there, and it's a lot of the values that she saw, at least in Europe and in the West, that made a difference in her thinking. And one of the things, here's what she said in part of her biography. She says, when people say that the values of Islam are compassion, tolerance, and freedom, I look at reality, at real cultures and governments, and I see that it simply isn't so. She could see what the values of Islam produced in the slavery that she felt as a woman living as an Islamic woman, and how that, you know, basically she had no freedom at all. She goes on to say, people in the West swallow this sort of thing because they have learned not to examine the religions or cultures of minorities too critically for fear of being called racist. It fascinates them that I'm not afraid to do so. She goes on to say, she's talking about the responsibility that she feels in trying to help people understand the experience that she had growing up as a Muslim. She says, perhaps I could start by telling people that values matter. What you believe matters. And if you've had values in your life that keep causing you problems, you might start to say there was something wrong with the things that I have valued. And there might be something wrong with the way I think. And that's why Peter can say, you've been ransomed from those futile ways passed down from your forefathers. Again, I know he's talking about in context the ways of Judaism, but to extend that analogy further, I don't think I'm at all out of line to say, you know, we've all had some ways of thinking that have not served us well, and we need to be able to think about how those things are or are not serving us at this point. We have values now given to us by God that should be guiding us. The first is that we have been ransomed by the blood of Christ. Peter makes that point very strongly. And I think if there's any grace in what Peter is saying, that's it right there. You have been ransomed. He may not use the word grace. Well, he does actually use the word grace. At some point he does further down here, I believe. But it's inherent in us being ransomed. We were slaves. There was no way we could do anything for ourselves. We had no way that we could rebel. We had no way to break the bonds of our chains. And yet God ransomed us. Just like the reading that I did, Captain Riley, they actually paid the Arabs to buy him back out of slavery. And that was the whole story that he was trying to tell. We have been ransomed by the blood of Christ. The second value is that God will judge us impartially. How we behave does in fact matter. The third value that we have is that we must always be prepared for those things that wage war against our souls. I know there's many other things, but those are the three things, the three values that Peter gives us in this lesson here. In verse 13, Peter says, we set our hope fully. Here's the word. I knew it was here somewhere. We set our hope fully on the grace that will be brought to us at the revelation of Jesus Christ. So Peter understands grace. If you do all those things and you set your hope on that grace, those are the values that now guide us to proper conduct. And so I simply conclude with Peter's exhortations. Be prepared. Conduct yourselves with holiness. Trust in the imperishable blood and the redemptive, the ransoming blood of Jesus Christ. It is our only certain hope for redemption.